everybody. Welcome back to Hot D, Bald Moves, officially unofficial podcast for all things HBO Max's House of the Dragon. Joining me is my host, Jim, as we are going to, for the next 10 weeks, actually about the next 9 weeks, we're going to have to do some schedule shuffling here. We're going to be covering alongside Maester Anthony, who earlier this week dropped his coverage, retrospective coverage of season one of House of the Dragon. We're going to be reviewing the written accounts, the written material, the Fire and Blood book written by George R. R. Martin. That's a complete Targaryen history, volume one. I guess it's an incomplete Targaryen history then, huh? just as a little funsy, just as a way to get us back into the spirit. It's been a while since House of Dragons been on air. I've uploaded and downloaded many universes worth of lore. So rewatching the shows, covering the book differences, going to get our pumps really primed. This is also, if you're a long-term listener to our Game of Thrones coverage, this is the first time that Jimbo here is dipping his little toe
Harris, please. Come on.
He's dipping his little toe into the waters, the turbulent waters we call A Song of Ice and Fire.
Yeah, indirectly, I suppose.
So yeah, like we're going to be reading the chapter Heirs of the Dragon, about the first 15 or so pages. This is this is a massive reading compared to some weeks. The actual events covered is a few paragraphs, but since they start in the Great Council of 101, and this chapter talks about all that, and the thing that really, I guess we want to get right to it. No spoilers for the future of House of the Dragon.
Mm-hmm.
Probably spoilers for Game of Thrones. And the larger, you know, there's probably going to be some spoilers about the Blackfyre Rebellion. Probably some spoilers for Aegon's conquering. So this is going to be talking a lot about A World of Song, Ice and Fire, but we will not be spoiling House of the Dragon beyond season one. If you haven't seen House of the Dragon season one, it's a great time to jump in. You can join us week to week, but I just want to say that going forward. Because the thing that really jumps off me is how carefully Martin sets the complicated political stakes here, where it's almost like something like this was inevitably going to happen because of almost. I got the sense in reading this early goings that House Targaryen at the turn of the second century was almost a victim of its own success.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the things that stood out to me, too. I look at, like, early on in this reading, they talk about how I think it was Jaehaerys had like 14 sons or 14 children.
Queen Allison and her Valyrian steel womb.
Yeah.
Birthed 13 children.
And only four of them survived to any degree of adulthood. Obviously, none of us survive in totality, but to become players in this story. And that to me was part of that, you know, setting up, boy, these Targaryens, they sure have a lot of children. They sure are prolific in their progenitoring of their success. And that's the thing. I look at that and I say, okay, the situation here with Jaehaerys is not really much different than the situation with Viserys that we actually see in House of the Dragon. And it gives me the impression that even if Viserys were to make all the right moves, and it's, you know, pretty arguable that he didn't, even if he gave the realm exactly what they wanted, it just kicks the can down the line because of the way that their society is structured and the number of children that end up out there. And I know Viserys, like, you know, his bench wasn't very deep, but also, you got a lot of people who are going back in history and saying, I have a claim for this, I have a claim for that, I'm the son of this person, the whatever. So it doesn't seem to me like there was an easily seen solution here. And Jaehaerys had, like, maybe the best compromise, because he was deathly afraid of the same shit that Viserys is afraid of.
Yeah.
And that arguably Great Council is the only thing that saved the realm at that point.
Yeah, he's arguably one of the greatest Targaryen kings in Westerosi history. He ruled for something absurd. It's like over 80 years, like since he was like a teenager till his death at 96. And you know, when Aegon the First conquered Westeros, he had the one guy, he had his two sister wives that were married and in love with him, bearing him both children, and they all had three dragons. There's no question who is in charge. It's King Aegon. Well, flash forward 100 years, and now you've got a dozen Targaryen princes with silver hair. They mm-hmm. all have dragons. Even one of the princes, Jaehaerys's princesses, I think it's Syrella. Sarah. She actually is ruling Volantis as a queen in her own right. Like, the Targaryens mm-hmm. are actually spanning the globe and extremely successful. Well, you have this problem. You'll probably remember in the Game of Thrones series how you had these second son problems, where it's like you've got the firstborn, he's going to get everything. But if you have a second and a third and a fourth son, what are those? Do they go and become soldiers of fortune in Essos? Do they take the wall? Mm-hmm. They want their glory. Well, these are like minor houses. What if it's the royal family that just has all these capable, ambitious, and some incapable fail mm-hmm. sons? They all got dragons. They all got ambitions. They all got delusions of grandeur. Like it's a problem. This is a well known problem of like successful royal families. Once their family gets so big, there's only so many admiralties you can give out. There's only so many titles. There's only so many lands. Mm-hmm. But you still got people. I'm a prince too. Where's my castle? Where's my army? Where's the Targaryens are the disease of more, as Isaiah Thomas called it. You'll want that success to keep going. And eventually it's going to tear itself apart from within.
Yeah, whether it's that generation or the next or the one beyond that. Yeah, it just isn't sustainable.
Yeah. So there, one of the things we want to do is addition to give the background, that we also want to kind of talk about the differences in terms of like books versus mm-hmm. the show. And a lot of this was set up because Jaehaerys had this great situation where he had what they call the heir in despair. He had his first son Aemon, who everybody thought was badass and a capable leader and a great warrior. His son Baelor Baelon right behind him, who is King Viserys's father, mm-hmm. Also very well thought of. And you know, for the longest time, no one had the thought about this because you got the heir, you got the spare. Mm-hmm. But tragedy struck, and Aemon gets killed in a battle randomly. His brother goes to avenge him. Okay, now he's heir. And in the prime of his life, apparently in perfect health, he dies of a burst belly, which I believe is Maester speak for appendicitis.
Okay. Interesting.
Now, what do you do? Because you've got your eldest daughter, Rhaenys, as George Martin would like us to call her, who is an accomplished dragon rider, who's beautiful.
Well, that's his granddaughter. Fierce.
It's a granddaughter.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and she's the child of Baelon, mm-hmm. Who is the firstborn. But you know, she's a woman, and there's nothing that really says a woman can't rule Westeros. But there's just never been any precedent. There's a lot of this talk of precedent that Aegon, you know, because he had. It's just like, you know, and the inherent, I think, sexism of the times is just like, you know, she got passed over, which pissed off her. Pissed off Queen Alicent, kicked off the second of the quarrels where she just fucked off and left the king for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. The other difference between the book and the show is they compress a lot of this to happen, you know, a lot of this bad blood to happen during the showtime. But like this happens a few years before the show. This pisses off Corlys, her husband, Corlys Velaryon, mm-hmm. so bad that he resigns his admiralty, leaves the council, and fucks off to his throne on Driftmark. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen in the show. He's still very much a part of the king's council, the small council.
Yeah, I assumed maybe he had in the show resigned earlier and then come back at some point. Yeah. But yeah, they don't really make that clear.
So the King Jaehaerys, who is this time at this point, he's old. I believe his wife had died the year before. He's alone. He's maybe starting to lose his grip on stuff. He got so desperate that he had his last son, who is this kind of frail 40-year-old person who took the Maester's chain years ago, had now become an archmaester. He called him down to King's Landing. He's like, "Will you be the king?" And he's like, "Fuck no." But very wise, him and his brother hatched this plan for this great council. And they spent a lot of time in the book setting this up, and this is what you see in the opening moments of season one, episode one of House of Dragon. Everyone gathering in the largest castle, which is the partial ruins of Harrenhal. They talk about how, like, some individual lords, notable lords, brought 300, 400, 500 people here. It was briefly the fourth largest city in Westeros, right behind Lannisport, King's Landing, and what was the other one? Old Town, where the Citadel's based out of. So he calls this, and he kind of washes his hands of it. In the show, they show the king kind of presiding over it. In the book, they say that he remained in King's Landing to give an air of impartiality to this. So that's another kind of change. You called one out too in our pre-show talks, a pretty major change.
The way that they frame this council is that it is sort of a runoff between the two most qualified, or the two people with the strongest claim to the throne, which is Viserys, who ultimately becomes the king, and then his cousin Rhaenys, who in the book it's different. It's yes, she is like kind of the avenue through which the other claim is made, but it's her son, who would be like, I guess, the eldest son of the eldest son of the king. So she has a very strong claim through that, or he does. But in the show, they make it very, very much like, oh, this is a woman versus a man. And I think that's actually a good change, because the point they're trying to make there is women are not allowed to be queens in this realm. And this is tradition, and this is expected, and this is what causes the war and the strife and everything, right? So I think it's a smart change.
Yeah, and there's like minor differences in the book. Laenor is actually younger than Laena, the daughter and son, and they make him older in the show. But all these changes, to me, I think you're dead on. They just make the political situation easier for the casual viewer to grasp. And you know, it's like, okay, Laenor gets passed over as a six-year-old boy. Does he hold a grudge? But the way they make Rhaenys, where she's effectively passed over twice. When her father dies, it should have flown to her, but since he had no male heirs, it went to Baelon or Baelor. And then when the council gets to debate all this over, and there was a bunch, they talk about all these, like, Martin loves to inflate the page count by talking about shit that doesn't matter. He invents like seven different cadet branches of the Targaryen lines bastard children of Maegor and all these other, like, a page and a half bullshit that doesn't matter before it's down to Laenor and Viserys. But making it Rhaenys versus Viserys, That's you can really got an axe to grind. And it's just like you said, simplifies. This is all about the inherent sexism of the patriarchy as depicted in Westeros and the women's struggle within it. So almost everything is done to just simplify that succession so that it's always just, oh, can't be a woman, it's got to be a man.
Yeah, but it's never that simple, right? Even in Jaehaerys's day, it's not that simple. In Viserys's day, it's not that simple.
And there's a lot of things going for Viserys, other than the fact that he had a cock, as Queen Alicent's opinion was. The fact that he was the last Targaryen to ride Balerion the Dread. This was Prince Aegon's, the King Aegon's personal dragon mount, the Black Death. The biggest dragon that ever lived in Westeros. He flew it as an elderly dragon. He essentially swung his leg over and took him for like two or three laps around King's Landing. Like, Balerion was not happy to be roused. He was not happy to be flying. And then he essentially is like, okay, I did it. I rode the biggest, baddest dragon. I think I'm good with this. And then Balerion died not too long after that. And Viserys never took another one. But that, you can imagine, the guy who rode the infamous dragon of Aegon the Great himself, Aegon the Conqueror, that had to carry a lot of weight with both the small folk and the large folk as well. The other thing is, Viserys is really well liked. He was very outgoing. Gregarious. They call him generous and open-handed, since he was not above spending the treasury to win friends and influence people.
And you see that kind of in the tournament that they put on in this, because the rest of the time you're only really told that, right? In the small council meetings, yeah. You hear that he's been very generous with the way that they've set up the night watch, or not the night's watch, the city watch, is that what it's called? Mm-hmm. The gold cloaks. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's been very generous with that. He's kind of willing to spend some money to make the realm happy. And then in this tournament, that's where you see him being the kind of gregarious and fun-loving guy. Smiling, he's clapping, he's happy, he's enjoying the show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They also do a detour to talk about how badass Corlys Velaryon is. Talk about when in
I skimmed that part because I was like, this doesn't have anything to do with the show right now. So
he's like the kind of Han Solo of his day. They talked that he crossed a narrow sea by the time he was six. The captains had never seen such a natural sailor. At 16, he became a captain in his own right. Tried to sail north to find the fabled Northwest Passage around Westeros, but he got turned around by frozen seas and icebergs the size of mountains. He then personally designed his own ship and built it, called the Sea Snake. This he sailed further west than any Westeros he had, all the way to the land of E.T., which is essentially Westeros' surrogate for China. Like, this is the Silk and Spice Road, and he was Columbus before his time, and there was no America in his way. So he just found that, and I guess his first voyage doubled the wealth, and he had so much Silk and Spice money that they said briefly he eclipsed the Lannisters in terms of wealth.
Yeah.
And he spent a lot. He also
He tries to use that to influence the council in order to get Rhaenys on the throne here. Does not work out well. And shockingly, it has quite shockingly little effect to me. They said that the vote came down to not just like, oh, they edged him out, Viserys, by a little bit, but it was like 20-1 is the rumor.
I think that George made a mistake here because, like, he talks about how charismatic and, like, heroic. This is like Charles Lindbergh fused with Henry Ford. You know, he's got the money, he's got the fame, he's got the adventuresome. Yeah. He talks about how him and his wife, who was also very well-liked and admired, dragon rider in his own right, and how ambitious he was, that the Velaryons were essentially Targaryens before the Targaryens. They were the first of old Valyria that came to settle in Westeros. Mm-hmm. They weren't dragon riders, but they were natural seamanship. It was like the admiral position on the small council was so firmly held by the Velaryons that a lot of people just considered it hereditary because it's always going to be the firstborn Velaryon. They're the best sailors. And that because of this, when he married Rhaenys, and, you know, she's got the silver hair and she's a dragon rider, like, he had dreams of, like, my children are going, the Valyrian blood myself, my children are going to be sitting on that Iron Throne.
Mm-hmm.
So I think all that comes across in his characterization of the show, but it's a little bit more richer, you know? I thought that going back to, like, sometimes George makes mistakes, like, he made the wall crazy high, and I remember there's a interview where he's talking about going to the cliffs of Dover and realizing that these were like two-thirds the height of his wall. Like, Jesus Christ, I made a big wall. Like, the wall's too big. There's no way you could build a wall with even Brandon Builder with magic and whites. There's no way they're gonna build. Like, I think it's 20-1 because he's telling a story of like Han Solo with $1 trillion going in to Coruscant and still can't do more than 12. Like, if you said 5-1 or 3-1, that would still be an overwhelming.
And it bleeds into the conflict itself. You know, if there's 20-1 armies who support one person versus the other, you'd kind of expect them to just be completely defeated in a day or something, right? Like, they have no hope of winning this. But the show and the books, I mean, they absolutely want us to think that there is hope. And maybe it comes down to who exactly that one out of 20 votes is. Maybe you get 20 lesser lords who don't have any real strength. And then you have the one who's, you know, a Lannister or something who really does have some might. Or Tyrell.
They did mention a few of the people. I know that the Baratheons were one of the ones that were kind of aggrieved that that they didn't get a bet. And you can see, you can see at the end of season one, some of these fracture lines starting to
You can see it at the end of this episode, man. Like when Bormund, it's Bormund Baratheon who shows up to pledge fealty to Rhaenyra. When Viserys makes her his heir, and you can see the look of like disgust on his face. And in fact, when he takes the knee there to pledge fealty, they don't even have him say, "I pledge loyalty to Rhaenyra." They end his sentence at Viserys. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was super interesting, which might inform the future of the Baratheon's place here.
So this is such an overwhelming result that this is kind of like, you know, it always been assumed that a man can't sit the Iron Throne, kind of in the same way that everyone assumed that presidents would only take two terms in office because that's the precedent that George Washington set. But this council was largely seen like the constitutional amendment after they with Roosevelt. It's like, okay, you literally can't serve more than two terms. Yeah. You literally can't be a woman and sit the Iron Throne.
The
this
people
is just
spoken.
Now an ironclad. Well, when we say the people, we're talking about the lords and ladies. Always remember,
but
this is an early form of representational democracy of the lords and ladies going and they even talked about like how even Dorne, who wasn't technically and in a real way under the rule of the Iron Throne, they still were able to send representatives. That's how cautious they were about gauging the popular support of this. So at the same time, it had been another tradition where the king, you would name his heir to the Prince of Dragonstone. And then when they came of age, they would become the hand and then help the king administer their duties. And Jaehaerys broke with this. His old time, like 41-year-old, had served him 41 years, his hand died. And instead of making Viserys the hand, he kept him on Dragonstone. But since he was still kind of young and unseasoned, he was in his early 20s, he brought Otto Hightower down from Old Town to be his hand. And it seems like, even from the book perspective, this is another ingredient that goes into the stew that will become the Dance of Dragons.
Oh, yeah. You can really... Yeah, yeah, you can see that. Speaking of coming of age, maybe I could take a George Martin-esque aside here and talk about ages, because that was another big thing that stood out to me in the show. Everybody's a lot different age than they're supposed to be. They give exact years in the book, as far as like what year everything is taking place, right? The show effectively takes place in 112, I think, AC. Mm-hmm. There's mention of other specific dates. You find out that Queen Amma, who is Viserys' wife, was 11 when they got married.
But they didn't make her
like 30 in the time of the show.
They didn't consummate the marriage until she was 13.
Oh, so it's okay. It's okay.
They waited 2 years till she bled, and then they...
Good for them. The other thing... they say that Rhaenyra was born in 97... which would effectively have made her mother 15. So Amma would have been 15 when she was born. Maybe that timing works out, but she looks older than 30 in the show, I'll say that, because they wanted to, I think, appropriately age her with Viserys. Although Viserys was very young when they got married, too. He was 16. So there wasn't like a crazy age difference as you think about it in medieval terms. And then the thing that really stuck out to me is Viserys' nickname. The people started calling him the Young King, which is interesting in context because he's 26 when he takes the throne. And, you know, that's probably pretty young for a king. But if you look at his grandfather, Jaehaerys,
the old king,
he was 14 when he took the throne. So, like, call him the Young King. Why are you calling this ancient 26-year-old the Young King?
It goes, when you have like plausibly four generations of people living and dying under the old king, then he's Jude Law, you know, he's the young pope, kind of situation.
Totally.
It's such a whiplash. You get the 96-year-old guy, now you got the strapping 26-year-old guy. There's a lot of other interesting, really cool stuff they've got here that. So you got that age gap. In the books, Alicent's actually almost a decade older than Rhaenyra, which adds into their personal kind of enmity. But I actually think it's a really smart change to make them grow up and be like the betrayal's a lot more personal and kind of petty at the same time. The jealousies were built on a much other thing than, you know, Rhaenyra just being younger and prettier, which is kind of the theme in the book. So I think they did a good job. They also kind of set up the Viserys gambit of Alicent kind of being fed to an older king for influence, because Alicent, when she was a teenager, would read to the old king on his deathbed. Yeah.
There's still lots of hot D left to talk about. We'll be right back after the break.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. And now, back to Hot D.
And there's also, like, because the big change, just to get it out of the way, is all that prophecy stuff at the end of the episode where Viserys says, I got to bring you into the secret. And this is the thing that the Song of Ice and Fire, that Aegon, the dream that he had, that doesn't appear in the book at all.
Okay.
And but there's this I didn't even catch this. This is the probably third or fourth time I've been through this material. They talked about how what she was reading to Jer Harris on his deathbed was Septon Barth's Tome of Unnatural Histories. And at first I was like, oh, are they trying to essentially speculate that she was reading him erotica or something? But I looked it up, and this was a natural history in that it would delve almost exclusively into the biology of dragons and how they were first domesticated and how the Targaryens... and this is the quote that everyone, you know, when we heard that dragons are sexless or their sex can change as rapidly as flame. This is the material. This is the book that material comes from. And I wonder if that got like Condell's. I know this came from George too, but also like these King kind of meditate on these histories and is learning to drag, because they've been trying to turn over this prophecy in their own head. And this is an early hint of that. I thought that was an interesting little buried detail.
I'm going to talk a little bit more about Allison. I thought it was interesting because I didn't know that she was a companion to Jaehaerys as his health was failing and he was dying. Mm-hmm. And she did, you know, roughly what we see her do in the show, where she goes to the king and reads from the book. It seems like that's her go-to move. But the thing that struck me there is, I guess when I saw the show, I was looking at Otto sending her to Viserys and going, ugh. That's gross, dude. Mm-hmm. This is your daughter. Don't send her in here. Knowing she has this history with the old king, and they don't make mention of anything untoward happening there. It was just a sick old man being comforted by a girl reading a book. It doesn't seem nearly as weird.
I don't think there's any sex implied, because he was so senile at this point that he thought that she was his long-lost granddaughter finally returned to him. So he was just like...
Yeah, so that totally reframes that scene for me. I don't think this is Otto sending her to go pleasure the king. To me, this is her doing the thing she did for the previous king.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is weird because you can't do that with the time, right? She'd be 5 years old or whatever, and there's no way she could read to this king and comfort him while he's dying. But the show doesn't mention that, so...
Right.
There's a weird tension there.
There's pluses and minuses with what they do to the character's age. So they talk about how there's another little ingredient in the stew that's the Dance of Dragons they introduced. The fact that we talked about how there's so many princes that their Targaryens had a habit of marrying their children to each other and to the cousins, but there were so many of them that they couldn't do that. And so if you can't marry to your own family, the next best thing is to marry to another high lord or lady. And
that's what
Targaryens,
I always say, yeah.
Yeah, if you can't marry to your kids, marry them to a high lord or lady. Then that started wedding the Targaryens are all the outsiders, the colonizers, but this started really putting them into the fabric of Westeros, and this established a web of complex alliances that will cause the dance to be as bad as it's going to be. Spoiler alert, it's war. Dance of Dragons gonna be super bad. You notice there's hardly any dragons in Dany's time. Lots of dragons here. Read between the lines. And they mentioned that, like, for the first years, this went great. Otto was a great king. Viserys was portrayed as a much more competent king in the book. Like, you know, generous and spend, but he also had a ton of treasure, and it was a time of peace. Mm-hmm. So,
and the realm loved him for it, too, right?
But they mentioned that as this happened, there was two heads that kept butting. One was Otto Hightower, who over time had become imperious, proud, brusque, and haughty. And the lords both resented him for his kind of like high and mighty behavior and was jealous of his almost exclusive access to the king. And Daemon Targaryen. Who is described as everything that he is not: charming, hot-tempered, ambitious, impetuous, moody. He's got the Dark Sister, the other Targaryen ancestral sword that personally given to him by the old king because he's such a badass. He's like, you got to have this sword, kid. And that Viserys keeps giving him things to do, you know, to occupy his time, makes him master of coin, master of law. This is all mentioned in the show, and he's kind of got bored with them all. Now he's got his hands on the city watch, where he's actually got potentially thousands of men under arms. He finds them kind of a ragged, ill-equipped bunch, and he's the one that the reason the city watch is called the Gold Cloaks, because he gave them all fine cloaks, black mail, good armor, good sword, training. And just like in the show, Daemon just loved roughing up the poor and illegals of King's Landing.
Yeah. They give specific, not accounts of it, but specific things he liked to do, right? Slits the noses of thieves, and he cuts off the hands of pickpockets and
gelds sort of the rapists.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he does that. The other thing they mention is that he's especially fond of Rhaenyra. And she him, because every time he'd come over from an exotic land from his dragon, that he would give her these expensive gifts. We see this in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
But he had this dual reality where it's like, you know, he's known as the prince of the city, but also the lord of Fleabottom, because he had very profane interest. He loved to gamble and he loved the whore. And the whore he loved the most was Meseria, this dancer from Lise, who had a special fascination for him, and that she was his favorite. The White Worm, Misery, as she's called. You know, she's got a little bit more of an expanded role in the series, as we'll come to appreciate, but they're establishing her here.
Yeah.
There's a detour. This is the one I was really looking forward to talking. The detour into sourcing. The maester, the archmaester, because so this the conceit of this whole archmaester is essentially this whole book, Fire and Blood, is written by this Maester Gildane, who served from the time of the King Aegon, the Duncan Egg King and Aegon, till the early days of Robert Baratheon, who's trying to chronicle the, and he cites several sources here. You know, Grand Maester Runciter, who is a Grand Maester at the time, his official journals, the decrees and the documents that the king himself signed. But there's two primary sources, Septon Eustace, who served in the royal sept and was the royal confessor to King Viserys, and Mushroom. If you've been listening to Bald Moves House of Dragon coverage, you have heard me referred to Mushroom.
Oh, boy.
Jim, let's talk about Septon Eustace. Is exactly what you expect. He's a church boy. He's not above talking about gossip and rumor, but he tends to take the high road. Mushroom delights in taking the low road. What was your impression of Mushroom?
Yeah, they both have kind of their inroads to where you could see them getting information, right? I mean, the maester is there. The Septon is there in the Royal Sept, in the Red Keep, so he's got some proximity. He'd probably be counseling kings and whatnot. And then Mushroom is the court jester, the court fool, essentially. And he has a reputation, I guess, as being a little bit slow, a little dumb. And so maybe some kings and some princes and princesses will let some information slip and think, he won't remember this tomorrow, or he doesn't understand what we're talking about.
He's an idiot. Yeah.
And perhaps he wasn't, because he wrote down, or at least he had someone transcribe a lot of his stories. This might be where my inroad, I guess, to reading this book is going to be, because I want to hear the Lord tales, the Lord stories of bad behavior the Mushroom has to tell. I'm excited
you're
for this. Yes.
You're gonna.
And there's an illustration in this book that makes me even more excited. I can't tell what Mushroom is doing exactly, but he's performing. It looks to me like he's breaking water balloons with his ass, much to the pleasure of Viserys and of ever young Rhaenyra.
Yeah, it looks like he's farting confetti, like he's burst a balloon that's full of confetti, and it's just like the height of humor. What I think is interesting is that the Maester Gildane is essentially saying, hey, I'm just putting all these sources out here. The student can choose what they, you know, believe. Ryan Condal really takes that to the hilt. And I was assuming before we started this that he would kind of steer towards the middle. He actually doesn't. He takes some bold strokes, as we'll see. And the other thing that's interesting is that, like, I feel like Gildane overvalues Mushroom's testimony, because a later king, King Balon the Blessed, who became this, like, ultra church boy, like a fundamentalist Christian version of the say, he had all of the Mushroom's tomes round up and burnt in his era. And I think the maester assumes that's because, well, it was the truth
too,
that
true,
he was trying to keep it from getting out. Fortunately, a few surviving copies of Mushroom's tales are still surviving into the 300s in the era of Danny and John. But, like, I think it's like, no, Baylor to Blessed, he was just burning pornography. I don't think he was like, oh, my God, this is the truth of my great grandparent. But
maybe
because
they
tell
also
the maester's like,
it's some of the stories in there are corroborated by other things. It's verified that some of the information in Mushroom's testimony is valid. Is real.
And you can definitely see the word Gildane when they agree. He's like, yeah, this is. And but you compare this to what you consider, which I think we're considering House of Dragon, is the truth. This is like a camera was embedded in the medieval.
Yeah.
It's the point of view. Like, this is what really happened, as much as any fictitious thing happened. The other thing that's that raised my eyebrows when I first read it is that the this Tales of Mushroom is written by an anonymous scribe.
Yes.
This is almost like putting in like a biblical context. So it's like, okay, we're talking about a guy, Jesus, who told me the story. Was it the apostle? No, it's Luke. It's this physician that hung around with Paul. and mm-hmm. never really knew him. Okay, well, did Luke actually write it? It actually might have been someone that knew Luke, but
surely Matthew, so Mark, like, or John had some firsthand account. Nah,
you start getting to where it's like, then, you know, we all know that George Martin wrote this. He's having a lot of fun writing his fake history. Like, I just, when I was writing his first time, I'm like, is he trying to tell me the mushroom's full of shit? As we'll see. Maybe not.
The thing is, Mushroom is entirely missing from the show, because he was a fairly, I mean, as you can see from this illustration and the description of him being around in the court, he was a fairly big part of the lives of Rhaenyra and Viserys during this time, and he's not even mentioned in the show.
And that, you know, you'll hear me in the preview, material of season one of House of Dragon, where that was one thing I was like, a dark horse, like, what a Peter Dinklage...
Right.
Plays under heavy makeup a version of Mushroom, where like that's like the framing device, is that he's telling the story in some kind of ribald way as an old man, like an old dwarf.
Right.
Yeah. But I don't think that's happened. I don't think it will happen, but it'd be cool.
Mm-hmm.
So we're getting close to where and the other thing that's really funny about this is he talks about all these sources just to say, he spends like a page and a half talking about how different these sources, just to say that all sources agree that Otto fucking hated Daemon.
Yeah.
So, and his organizing principle was that he cannot under any circumstances be allowed to become the king. That was Otto's like whole deal.
Yeah, he said he'd be a second Maegor the Cruel or worse, which is a line from the show, but in the book he sends that as a letter to his brother, says it to the face of the king, although he may have also, but
yeah.
That's pretty bold.
This is a time Kristen Cole, this is a paragraph in the book, but during this tournament, Kristen Cole beats Daemon, who pisses off Daemon just like he does in the show, but also enamors him to Rhaenyra. That's when she becomes, this all takes place much later in the books or in the show.
Yeah,
he eventually becomes
weird.
Her sworn shield. They set this relationship up here,
but it's a different tournament in the book. It's the celebrating the rise of the ascension of Viserys, which happens 9 years before the show, and Rhaenyra is only 7 years old at the time, as opposed to her being 14 here.
Right.
And in the show, he defeats, I don't know why this is important, but he defeats the Baratheon, two Baratheon boys, as opposed to defeating, in the book, the Cargill twins, which we'll see later in the show, Eric and Arik.
Yeah.
To my consternation.
It's interesting that they didn't take an opportunity to introduce them, because they're going to be much bigger players going forward. Around this time also, Lionel Strong joined to be Master of Law, and we talked about him a lot last season. I fucking love Lionel Daleel. He was a big, strong man, renowned in battle. People assumed he's slow-witted because he preferred to listen and not talk, but he actually this hit a brilliant mind who had a keen grasp of all the laws, and is actually an incredible advisor to the king, as we'll find out in this series. His two sons, Harwin Breakbones and Laris the Clubfoot, which we get well acquainted with in the series.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to say something?
There's something that's going to happen with Cole later in this season that I won't spoil in case it's your first time around, but Lionel Strong wasn't on the council until after that event that is depicted later in the show happens, because it happens earlier in the book. And I guess that's interesting that they sort of advance that too. There's a lot of rejiggering here that Condal is doing,
especially the small council, like Valerian, Corlys is still on small council. Lionel's not, there's a little discrepancy of the maesters and
those choices seem kind of wild. Like, how do you organize that? You must have just poured through these books and decided, okay, what are the most interesting characters for us? Yeah. And how do we arrange it so that they're there at the beginning of the show? And it still makes sense in the context of what's to come.
I wonder how they do that too. Like, is there alternate universes? Like, we got Alicent and Rhaenyra. This is going to be a lot of the central conflict. They're 10 years apart. Is it interesting we make them the same age? What ripple effects does that have?
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, what if we make them, like, it's that they're, because you're right, you have to at some point, every change you make causes you to make another change. Anything you make that's like, well, I can't really have Viserys marry this girl at 6. It'd be creepy. Advance her up 10 years. Okay, that also makes this impossible. So it's like, yeah, I don't know.
You have to kind of consider all of those changes that would need to be made before you can really make any changes.
Seems
like a monumental task.
So things, the realm proceeds in peace for a few years. We get the 105 where the book agrees with the show. Queen Amma dies in childbirth. There is no, like, this is literally a 3-sentence thing that happens in the book. There's no agonizing over where you should do a C-section or whether you should save the queen. She dies in childbirth, and her son, the first male heir that they've had, the one that's, you know, the one that they're counting on, dies the next day. Mm-hmm. And this, the book contains this naked boast that Daemon makes in the brothels about, you know, air for a day. I love, love, love the way they handle it in the show where you can see him saying that, but the way, the moment that they show Daemon, he's definitely reflective and sad for his brother. So did he say that? Did he say that later in the nights when he's in his cumps? Did he say it in a mournful way? And just the... it came out wrong.
Is Otto making this up entirely because he's an ambitious
true.
Proud
is he
man.
Twisting it because he's got his spies and he's trying to tell, you know, his organizing principle is Daemon can't be king. Regardless, Viserys gets pissed, throws him, banishes him from King's Landing. In the book, the Daemon said that he grabbed his best gal, Miseria, the white worm, and takes off on his dragon Caraxes, the red worm. Flies off the Dragonstone, and he's not to be seen for a while. And in both the book and the show, Rhaenyra is made the heir, which is a huge overturnal of precedent. And you know, we've seen in our own recent history that the precedent's important. It's not to be run lightly. And the other thing, obviously, is the big prophecy. This is...
yes.
Not in the books, even a little bit. So the question is, you know, why do you think that they put this big prophecy with the Valyrian steel blade that was the cat's paw dagger? It was...
that's the thing. I think that's the obvious Arya's reason, is to tie it back to Game of Thrones for the audience that they know has already watched that, and make it feel like all of this stuff is more connected directly.
Yeah, it feels like all of the spinoffs maybe even are going to be bound together by this one prophecy.
Could be.
And it's a damn shame that Game of Thrones ended the way it did, in my opinion, because this is all setting up the white that's turned out to be, you know, no more impactful than a mushroom fart in terms of like how it really impacts the realm and whatnot. So it's a damn shame. Imagine if Game of Thrones was an 11 out of 10 show and like there's just all this fascination with, oh my God, the prophecy. But clearly, yes, they are trying to make this a cinematic universe that all connects, not just through lineage, but through magic and prophecy. And to be fair, Martin does a lot of that himself. So there, Condal's just kind of like bringing to the forefront stuff that George has been doing in the background for over a decade now. So I guess that's about it for this. Is there anything else that jumps out? The one thing I don't want to ask you is like, do you see what I was saying about, like, people would ask me, are you excited for House of Dragon before I saw it? I'm like, I don't know. Like, how do you make a show out of this? Like,
yeah, the events are interesting.
We spent 15 pages reading to get to an hour of the show that probably only has 4 or 5 paragraphs that directly impact the course of the episode.
Yeah. And those 4 or 5 paragraphs are probably going to be mostly what we get for the foreseeable future in the show, right?
Yeah. No, they'll be like, but it's going to slow down. That's like, I don't know how long episodes going in advance, because we're going to slow down from like, you know, 15 pages to like maybe 15 paragraphs, maybe even 5 or 6 paragraphs in some weeks. So, but I think there'll definitely be these differences, like these slight shades of meaning, to see which did he go more to the Septon side of the rumor mill? Did he go down in the gutter with Mushroom? Did they get like, I think that's what's going to be the really interesting, the stuff like what didn't make the page, what did they change, and what can it tell us about season 2? So our goal for this is for you to be able to fake being a lore expert by the end of the series and be 100% hungry and ready for season 2 of House of the Dragon.
But still not to have spoilers for the next season. So
but not to spoil for next season.
Yeah.
The other thing I want to say is that there's going to be some week where we have to do two of these. We're not sure that it's going to how it fits in our schedule, because we thought we had enough. We thought we had 10 weeks to do this, but we had miscounted, and we only had nine. So we're gonna double up on one of these weeks to get everything done. But that shouldn't be a problem. Just have a little bit more hot. Maybe we can pair to. I'll look ahead, and we'll pair the small weeks together. Weeks together, hopefully. We will maybe have feedback depending on whether you want to send it. Whether we get it and whether it's relevant. Like, I don't really want to answer a whole bunch of like lore questions about the original series or stuff like that, but House of the Dragon, certainly fair game. The upcoming spinoff, perhaps. hotd@baldmove.com is how you send in that feedback. Support us at support.baldmove.com so we can keep making podcasts. And if you want to find out what else we're doing in the meantime, our social medias are @baldmove everywhere. That's going to do it for this week. Thanks to everyone for listening. Thanks to Jim for cracking a book and reading.
No problem.
Some Fire and Blood. We'll see you next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.